Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest is Richard Hollingham. He's a science journalist, an author, and a BBC radio presenter. And we're talking about his book, Blood and Guts, A History of Surgery. Richard, welcome back to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
No, it's great to be back on again.
Now, Richard, this is a pretty gory history, and you've made no bones about that. You talk about that in the beginning. I mean, you actually say that it could have been even gorier.
Well, I was rereading some of this in preparation for our chat, and it is quite gory, isn't it? And I didn't quite realize some of these sections, but it's realistic. And I think where I've tried to tone down the gore, I mean, I have told the story, I've told what happened as it was happening. I've tried to make it as real as possible. How I've avoided going into the really horrible stuff is to just avoid those stories. I mean, there's some aspects of the history of surgery that I really didn't want to get into, some aspects of the body I really didn't want to think about or get into. So that's kind of how I've got around it. But, I mean, it's a history of surgery. It's about cutting into the human body, about amputations, about brain surgery.
Oh, my God.
About all the horrors, the advances, the, you know, the greatness and the awfulness of surgery.
But one of the things that you've done, and I had not read a book before this about the history of medicine or surgery, you really successfully, through your writing, put the reader both in the situation of the patient and the surgeon. And you start that right up when we're talking about Robert Liston. For the first time in my life, I got a real feeling what it was like to be a patient on that table. And I wanted to run out of there. It's like I wanted the book like some patients did.
Well, that's what I was trying to do. I mean, it's slightly controversial because parts of this, the way of writing, is to write in the present tense, to put yourself in that position. But in those situations, we know exactly what happened. That's the beauty of surgery, because so many extensive notes were taken, and we even know what surgeons said at particular times. So you mentioned Robert Liston. I think he is one of the great heroes of surgery, and he often gets dismissed and people joke about the nature of his surgery. So he was a great early Victorian surgeon in London, and he was really the foremost surgeon of his day. So this is before anything like anesthetics.
Oh, God.
Or antiseptics. So the anesthetics, so people get hung up on this idea, well, you know, you need to be put to sleep to have surgery. But at the time, the quickest and the best way and the only way to live if you had a serious injury, say a compound fracture, so that's when the bone comes out through the skin, that would almost certainly get infected. So the only way, if you had a compound fracture of the leg, for example, or the arm, the only way to live, to survive, was to have surgery, was to have that amputation. And yet, there was no way of putting you to sleep. So the only way around that was to do the operation as quickly as possible. So Robert Liston could amputate a leg in 30 seconds.
I found that unbelievable. I found that absolutely unbelievable. But you go through the whole procedure he did. It must have been incredible to watch.
Well, actually, when you write it down, you think, actually, it's probably taken me longer to write this than he actually did it at the time. You know, it is absolutely extraordinary how quickly he did it, how efficiently he did it, compared to other surgeons of the time who took a lot longer. And you've got to imagine, I mean, I don't think it is possible to imagine the excruciating pain of having a limb amputated. And so Robert Liston was trying to do that as quickly and efficiently as possible. And also in doing that, but they didn't know it at the time, it minimized the risk of infection because you had the minimal exposure to the environment. And the operating theater environment wasn't what you imagine an operating theater be today with, you know, shiny, clean walls and everything antiseptic. There was no understanding of disease or the passage of disease. And so, I mean, they were filthy, and there were gas lamps above the operating table. There was a tray underneath with sawdust where the amputated limb would fall into. And, I mean, you know, there's some surgeons actually wore the same garments from operation to operation. In fact, some surgeons even shared the dressings from operation to operation. It just seems unbelievable. And these operations were theatrical experiences. So the operating theatre, it was a theatre. People would come to watch and come to watch the greatest surgeons of the day, such as in London, Robert Liston, operate on these patients and actually save their lives. So, you know, you can revel in the gore of it, if you like, but actually he was a lifesaver. I mean, he was brilliant, but he was also, as is a theme throughout the history of surgery, and, you know, even today to some extent, there was somewhat of an arrogance.
Oh, yeah.
To the man.
There's actually, you trace the evolution of arrogance in surgery. It's like sort of a sub theme. I mean, he was like the quintessential arrogant surgeon.
Yeah, and this would come back to haunt him. I mean, there is one operation that, you know, famously he did, where he amputated the leg of the patient, but he also accidentally amputated the fingers of one of his assistants. The operation was so horrible that someone in the watching had a heart attack, and the patient later died. So it's the only operation in the history of surgery with 300% mortality. Yeah, he's not the only one over the history of surgery who was extraordinarily arrogant. But I guess it's two sides of the same coin, because you had to have a degree of arrogance to take these risks to push the boundaries of surgery. I mean, if you jump forward quite a way to the great heart surgeons,
oh, yeah,
the pioneers of open heart surgery, one of my favorite surgeons, he's now little known, really, but at the time in the 1950s and 60s, a real pioneer, a surgeon called Walter Lillehei, absolutely extraordinary, pushing the boundaries, again, trying to save lives, you know, trying to save lives of, you know, the youngest children with serious heart defects. And this is before the time of a heart-lung transplant. So it was trying to work out, well, how do you operate? How do you do open surgery on a heart? First of all, how do you do open surgery on a heart that's beating, which is what they were initially doing? So cooling the body right down, often with these young children, cooling the body right down to get the heart beating very slowly and then being able to operate on it. But you couldn't do anything other than that until the heart-lung machine was invented. So what he did is brought in another person to act as a real-life heart-lung machine. So he connected the circulation of usually a relative, but actually sometimes a volunteer, to the circulation of a patient, normally a child that needed maybe a hole in the heart repairing, and connected the circulation together so you could stop the heart of the patient and use the circulation of the volunteer. This is called cross-circulation. And in the same way that Robert Liston's surgery had the potential for 300% mortality, this had the potential for 200% mortality. To you know, you could end up with both people dying, or at least with one with a serious injury. But it saved lives. And you've got to have, I mean, it's that borderline, isn't it, between arrogance and brilliance? Because if you didn't have these people pushing the boundaries, then lives wouldn't have been saved. And, you know, their ultimate motivation, they were lauded, but, you know, it was to save lives.
It's fascinating reading the early history of surgery. And bring it back to the Victorian period, 1842 is what you opened up with Robert Liston. The survival rate of any surgery, no matter how well done, was still incredibly lower than the survival rate of surgery today. And the biggest problem was antiseptics. I mean, people didn't understand cleanliness procedures for surgery. They would, you're right, the people would go from doing an autopsy right to surgery without washing their hands or anything.
Now, it does seem extraordinary that there was no, it's one of these things in the history of science that's been discovered and forgotten and discovered and forgotten.
Right.
This idea of,
right.
of of microbes or of cleanliness, even if, you know, at the time in Victorian England and the same in the US, that it was imagined that perhaps infection, if you like, if you know, it wasn't quite understood as the way we understand infection now, was something to do with the air, some sort of miasma or something in the air. And there were various attempts to, even if they didn't understand what was causing it, even understand that we're all covered, everything is covered in these creatures you can't see, in microbes. They knew that, you know, there were attempts to clean things up, and then more people survived. And then that was sort of forgotten or not adopted or not spread.
Well, wait.
So it does seem extraordinary.
Richard, it's even weirder than that in your book. I'm one of the pioneers, 1847, Ignaz Semmelweis, who discovers the cause of childbed fever and starts implementing cleanliness procedures. There's a rebellion by the medical establishment against the surgeons washing up and doing cleanliness procedures. It's not just that it was forgotten. It was rebelled against.
Yeah, no, I know. It's absolutely extraordinary what he said. Because it stung. So they were using this, you know, carbolic acid or types of bleach. It stung their hands. They didn't want to do it. They couldn't see the point of it. And so it gradually, he introduced it to hospitals. And this hospital suddenly, you know, the rates are shocking when you look at the number of women and babies that were dying in hospitals, I mean, right the way across the Western world. And Semmelweis comes along, introduces cleanliness procedures because it works. He doesn't exactly understand why, but it works, of surgeons washing their hands, of doctors washing their hands, midwives washing their hands. It works, but they don't like it. They don't like the procedure. They don't like him. They don't like the way it works. He never kind of roots it in the science, but it clearly works. But he gets sidelined completely. I mean, he ends up in a mental institution, and the idea again is forgotten. And that is what's extraordinary, because there's this period, and I think this is actually the most shocking period in the history of surgery, and perhaps in the whole history of medicine. So we can obsess about anesthetics and being put to sleep under surgery, because that's just terrifying, the idea of being awake during surgery. But that wasn't what was killing people. I mean, it's, you know, it's horrible, it's painful, it's everything. But at Robert Liston operation, 5 out of 6 of his patients survived. And these were, you know, people with pretty horrible injuries for the most part. Really not bad for that period. Once anesthetics were introduced, and Robert Liston was one of the pioneers of anesthetics. I mean, they were actually invented in a hospital in Boston. And you've got this new technology. You can put people to sleep. And when you can put people to sleep, you can spend longer doing the operations.
And you can do different kinds. Kinds of stuff. You can start really mucking around for long periods. The problem was in the beginning when they were working with ether, and then later they were working with chloroform. They didn't have the amounts figured out yet because they hadn't done any scientific things. So they would just give people a huge amount of either ether or chloroform, and sometimes they died of that.
Well, the problem with ether was it's highly flammable. So if you think back to Robert Liston's operating theatre where you've got this bench, I mean, really like a table, a pine bench where the operations were taking place on, you had a gas light just over the top. So you've got this highly flammable gas under a gas light. So there's a real problem there. The other thing the British surgeons didn't much like about ether was it was an American invention. So they were looking for a kind of British alternative, you know, because we are the British were the great pioneers of surgery, or so they thought. Came up with this with chloroform, which you used to see in, a lot of, I guess, 1940s, 50s spy films where, you know, they'll put a cloth over someone's mouth and they'll knock them out. The trouble with chloroform, it needs very precise measurements, the very precise amounts. But surgery, there was nothing precise about these people. And so they were just, you know, sprinkling a few drops on a cloth, putting it over someone's face, and they were going to sleep, or they were dying. Some people, quite a few people were dying. It was just you know, over the edge. You know, so again, there's this, you know, so anesthetics were not the, you know, they were a great invention to take away the pain, but, you know, they were killing people. And also because you could do all this different surgery, because you could then, you know, start opening people up, maybe try an appendectomy or something like that, with no understanding of disease control, more people were dying. So they were doing more operations, more people were dying. So actually anesthetics, it was all wrong, all the wrong way around. You know, no understanding of disease, but with anesthetics, more surgery, more deaths.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Richard Hollingham, science journalist, author, BBC radio presenter. We're talking about his book. It's an amazing history, but steel yourself for it. Blood and Guts, A History of Surgery. Richard, there's so many great stories in this, but I want to talk about two in particular. And they're not important stories by themselves, but Sometimes in the early years, people were trying surgery that absolutely had not a chance in hell of working. And I want to talk about James Spence and tooth transplants in 1765. This doctor was just transplanting teeth without, and just sort of hoping they would work.
Again, it's very, you know, well, it seems, you know, if you think, well, if you break a tooth, you just put another tooth in. it just seemed really obvious. And so, you know, a lot of these, you know, so these back street, I mean, you know, teeth were just horrendous. People's teeth were horrendous, particularly as you start seeing importing sugar and a large amount of, you know, increasingly eating more sugary food. So teeth decay was a terrible problem. And obviously the upper classes wanted perfect teeth. So these backstreet dentists, I use the term very loosely. Did you just get a beep then? Oh, getting a beep. Sorry, let me just pick this up.
This is what he would do, though, is he would advertise for donors. In other words, he would advertise for people who would get paid money to just go in. He would pull their teeth and then literally run into the next room and try it on the patient.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I mean, so you didn't have much money. You think, well, I will go and sell some of my teeth. People would queue up in the morning. They would have their teeth extracted. And then in the afternoon, he would implant them, and I use the term loosely, into other, you know, into the upper classes. So it was really a transition of teeth from the poorest to the more wealthy. And of course, it didn't work. You know, I mean, there's no understanding of how you would even do that, how you would even connect together circulation. I mean, we're talking sort of things that you could only do now with microsurgery, and certainly no understanding of rejection of the body, no understanding of tissue type, of blood type, anything like that. All these things do seem extraordinary. And I think with, you know, I suppose that comes under cosmetic surgery. And, you know, the sorts of things people would do, the sort of risks people would take to make themselves, I mean, quite apart from the donors, I mean, that's just horrible, you know, giving up your teeth for money. But the people who receive these things, you know, there's an element of, we still see it today with you know, some plastic surgery.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
This element of vanity about it. I mean, there's some, you know, particularly gruesome surgery around, you know, just over 100 years ago.
Oh, with wax? My God.
Wax. People wanting to mold, you know, it's what we can see today, but it's safe today. So instead of Botox or the fillers that some people will use today, hot paraffin wax could be injected under the skin of the face. So this is around about the turn of the 20th century. So we're into the sort of safe surgery arena now. So, you know, antiseptics have been invented. We haven't got local anesthetics as such. It's going to be incredibly painful. So, you know, a nose job around that time, and there were some places you could go to, particularly in France, where you could go to the surgeon. They would cut into, say you wanted a nose job, cut into your nose and inject hot paraffin wax under the skin. And then they had about 30 seconds to mold it to the perfect shape. I mean, there were obvious problems, apart from infection and severe burns and all the other problems.
And it didn't. And sometimes it just kept moving around.
Yeah, it would move around. So you could start off with this paraffin wax in your nose, and then it would gradually, you know, so you've got these people with this, you know, looks like to some extent their faces are melting. So it's gradually these lumps are moving around under this.
Richard, we're going to run out of time because there's so much to talk about. But I want to mention one person who had an interesting history, because the surgery was successful, but it was later banned by the church. And it was really early surgery. And I'm talking about Gaspar Tagliacozzi, the Italian nose job guy from 1597. There was a lot of problems with noses at the turn of this 16th century. People lost them to syphilis. People lost them to dueling. So people were literally without a nose. And he actually invented a technique. It was awkward and painful, but it worked to sort of reconstruct a nose.
Yeah, so there was some early nasal reconstruction where you take a flap of the skin from the forehead and then kind of twist it and turn it round to recreate a nose. But that wasn't very effective. What they realized early on, you had to keep the blood vessels connected. Tagliacozzi invented this idea of, rather than just taking it from the top of the forehead, using skin from the arm. So if you imagine that, you know, you need to rebuild the nose, a lot of men in particular, a lot were losing their noses through syphilis around that time. So you could cut into the arm, so the upper arm, and then you could connect the skin of that to where your nose was.
But you had to leave part of that flap connected to the arm.
You had to leave it connected. Yeah. So you basically, your nose is then where your nose is still connected to your arm. You know, if you could try this at home. If you put your hand at the back of your head and if you put your nose next to your arm, that can become quite uncomfortable after even a few minutes. So he invented this sort of strap arrangement. So people would need to, you know, those having this surgery would need to lie in bed with their arm connected to their face with this strap arrangement until the blood vessels took in the face, and then they could cut it away from the arm and then gradually over time reshape this nose, maybe using some cartilage from elsewhere. It rebuilt their nose. They weren't great. But this surgery, you know, this was one of those examples of surgery, early surgery, that became adopted again and again and again. And so this was used a lot in World War I to recreate the faces of soldiers who were appallingly injured in the trenches. And then later, with even more elaborate, what they call tube pedicles, so these, you know, really quite long sections of skin, again, in the Second World War, to rebuild soldiers' faces. And they were tremendously successful. So that example of early plastic surgery absolutely could carry on being used really up until the 1950s and 60s, when we start to see the development of microsurgery and actually being able to take some skin from somewhere else in the body and reconnect it and start joining up blood vessels, joining up nerves and all the rest of it. But, you know, that's a great example of, fairly horrendous surgery when you think about it, but actually it has a legacy and it made so many people's lives better.
Poor Tagliacozzi, though, but when he died, his reputation collapsed because the church accused him of medical practices. And so initially the church banned the procedure, even though it worked?
Well, you know, I don't want to get into the church versus science debates too much, but, you know, this it's not just that, to be fair, it's not just the church, it's the establishment in whatever form that can be. So when you talk about a lot of these surgical advances, it's the medical establishment. The medical establishment was against open heart surgery for a very long time.
I remember that.
You know, so the first, you know, true open heart surgery was done during the Second World War. It could almost certainly have been done many years before that. And some, you know, some experimental early surgery was done before that, but it really wasn't widely accepted. So, you know, this is establishment in any innovation, and it still happens today. And, you know, it's a balance again, isn't it? It's between the checks and balances of not pushing it too far, but also that establishment can hold back progress, and we've seen it with the development of antiseptics. You know, it's sometimes when it goes against the idea of common sense, you know, with antiseptics, the idea that everything and all of us are covered in these microscopic organisms that none of us can see. Well, that doesn't necessarily, we can't see them, so it doesn't necessarily make sense.
That's right.
So it really took many decades and pioneers like Lister in that case, to push and actually show the science and the proof that, you know, we were covered with all these bugs, and the only way to have safe surgery was to eliminate them in the operating theatre. And just sort of want to mention, actually, Joseph Lister, the pioneer of antiseptics in Glasgow, and what I love, all his things are still there in Glasgow in the Hunterian Museum.
Oh, cool.
If you ever go to Glasgow,
yeah,
in Scotland, it's just all his stuff is still there. And there is a jar in a glass cabinet in the Hunterian Museum in Glasgow, I saw the other day, of his urine. So the jar of Joseph Lister's urine in the Hunterian Museum in Glasgow, and it's still clear. And that was his point. But if you seal it in antiseptic conditions and you seal it, it won't get infected. So there's pure urine, pure 19th century urine in a glass case in a museum in Glasgow.
I
like those sort of museums.
I love those museums. We're completely out of time. We could talk about this book for years. My returning guest tonight has been Richard Holligham. Science journalist, author, BBC radio presenter, and we've been talking about his book. It's an amazing read. It's actually a thrilling and disturbing read. Blood and Guts, A History of Surgery. Richard, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.